This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we spend the entire hour with Professor Angela J. Davis, the author of Arbitrary Justice, The Power of the American Prosecutor, and the editor of the recently published book, Policing the Black Man. Her work describes what's really going on in the trenches and the dangerous shift in power from judges to prosecutors in sentencing and charging decisions.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In the halls of justice, it has been quipped, the only justice you find is in the halls. H.Rap Brown, a leader of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, said that justice in America means just us. There are 2.3 million people in American prisons today. A great proportion of them are African Americans. If you assume Europe has the same social situation that we do in America, it's a telling fact that we have seven times as many prisoners. Part of the explanation for this phenomena, in addition to the racist nature of the USA, is the power that the American prosecutor has. It is the power to choose whom to prosecute and for what crime. It is the power to obtain convictions, not to seek justice. It is a power that is discretionary and often open to abuse. This abuse is rarely reviewable or punished. We speak today with attorney and law professor Angela J. Davis. She's the author of Arbitrary Justice, The Power of the American Prosecutor. Her most recent book, Policing the Black Man, covers the key issues of the Black Lives Matter movement. Attorney Davis is a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law, where she teaches criminal law and criminal procedure. Prior to her career as a law professor, Davis was a public defender at the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia before becoming the agency's director. Angela J. Davis, not to be confused with Angela Y. Davis. Angela J. Davis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Angela, a lot of people think that police officers are the most powerful figures in the criminal justice system, but it's the prosecutors, isn't it? And why is this so?
Well, you know, I'm really happy about the fact that people pay so much attention to police officers. Of course, we must pay attention to police officers. They have a tremendous amount of power, a tremendous amount of discretion to stop people, search people on the street, and as we know from all of the attention with the recent killings of young black men, even use deadly force against individuals. So that attention to police officers' power and discretion is warranted and should continue. But I contend that prosecutors are actually the most powerful officials in the criminal justice system, and that's because although police officers have the power to bring an individual to the courthouse door, it's the prosecutor who has the power to decide whether that person remains in the court, becomes firmly entrenched in the court, and determines exactly what happens to that individual because of their tremendous charging and plea bargaining powers, which really determine the outcome of all criminal cases.
How do they get their jobs?
Prosecutors, depends on whether you're talking about a state prosecutor or a federal prosecutor.
Oh,
I pay a lot of attention to state prosecutors because as much as 99% of all criminal cases are actually handled on the state level, not on the federal level. And state prosecutors in the vast majority of states are actually elected officials. In all but four or five jurisdictions, they run for office every 2 or 4 years, just like other officials, but people don't really pay attention to prosecutor races. They are called district attorneys in some states. They're called state's attorneys in others. But oftentimes they run unopposed. They serve for decades. There are no term limits. And people don't pay attention to these races. And it's unfortunate because they are the most powerful officials in our criminal justice system. And we need to pay attention to them and hold them accountable in the democratic process. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen very often. It's changing a little bit, but it hasn't been happening over the years, which is why they've been able to get away with so much power and discretion, and many of them actually abuse that power and discretion, which is which is quite unfortunate.
Yeah, well, I want to get into that with you, but before I ask you that, I wanted to know if you know what percentage of prosecutors are African Americans.
So when we're talking about prosecutors, we're talking about the chief prosecutor. So just a bit about how it works. The elected official, who's called either a state's attorney or a district attorney, that person is in charge of their entire office of prosecutors, and they have the power to hire the prosecutors in their office. So if you're talking about what percentage of chief district attorneys or state's attorneys are African American, it's probably less than 2%. You know, the vast majority, something like 98% of chief prosecutors are white males. Very few women, very few people of color.
How do these prosecutors get the cases that they handle?
So the way that most prosecutors get the cases is through police officers making arrests on the street. So, you know, let's give an example. You know, someone is robbed, they call the police. The police officer comes. If they're able to identify the person who robbed them, the police officer arrests that person, brings the person to the courthouse, and then they recommend to the prosecutor whether that person should be charged or not. And a lot of people talk about how police officers charge you with a crime. Police officers don't have that power. It's the prosecutor. And it's usually through the person being arrested on the street. That's how the way it usually happens, particularly with run-of-the-mill crimes. Now, with white-collar crimes and other kinds of offenses, a lot of times the prosecutors initiate the charging process by investigating the person through a grand jury or so forth, and then the arrest is made afterwards. But usually it's an arrest and a recommendation to the prosecutor, which they can either take or leave. They can take the recommendation of the police officer, or they can decide not to. The prosecutor can decide, I'm going to charge you with whatever the police officer recommended, or they can decide to charge them with something greater or something less, or they can decide not to charge them at all. And all, that power is all in the hands of the prosecutor. That decision is made behind closed doors with no transparency. And that's how they get away with a lot of the misconduct and a lot of the disparate charging, where some people are charged and others aren't. Sometimes it plays out based on race and class, and that's how we oftentimes end up with a lot of these race and class disparities that we have in our criminal justice system today, because of decisions made by prosecutors.
Professor Davis, in your book, Arbitrary Justice, The Power of the American Prosecutor, you write about four significant points in the prosecutorial mm-hmm. process: the initial screening, the charging, plea officers, and then the final disposition. Let's discuss these. How do prosecutors mm-hmm. make decisions on whom to prosecute?
Mm-hmm. So the way it works, that's why it's interesting, because the title of my book is Arbitrary Justice for a reason. A lot of times it appears that the decisions they make are arbitrary, which is frightening when you think about it, because they have the power to take away a person's liberty and even their lives in states that have the death penalty. But the way it works is, and let me just give an example to sort of illustrate my point. Let's say a police officer arrests a person, and that person has 5 bags of cocaine on them at the time. And the police officer, let's say, brings the person to the courthouse and to the prosecutor and says, I recommend that you charge this person with possession with intent to distribute cocaine. Now, in most states, that particular charge is a very serious felony that carries a mandatory minimum sentence of as much as 10 years in some jurisdictions. So if that person is charged with 5 counts, each of which carries a mandatory 10 years in prison, let's say, they're facing 50 years in prison. Now, and let's say the prosecutor listens to the police officer and says, you know, I don't think I'm going to charge this person with that. I think I'll just charge them with possession of cocaine, which they have every right to do. Even if they have probable cause, which is all they need to charge the person, or even if they have the proof beyond a reasonable doubt that they need to convict them ultimately at trial, they can simply decide to just charge them with possession just because they want to, right? And there may be good reasons. I'm not saying they shouldn't do that. Maybe they say, I'm going to give this person a break because this person is a first offender, or, you know, maybe they think they don't have enough evidence to prove the felony at trial. So there may be good reasons why they're doing it, but sometimes there aren't good reasons. Maybe they know the lawyer, the family. Maybe the person's from a well-to-do family, and maybe that family has a lawyer who knows the prosecutor and comes and talks to the prosecutor and says, give this kid a break, you know, he's college-bound, let's not ruin his life. And along those lines, the prosecutor could even decide not to charge that person at all. They can just dismiss the charges altogether, right? So you can see how these decisions, which are made behind closed doors, can produce disparities. Because if there's one defendant who maybe is well-off, well-connected, you know, has, you know, connections, that person may get a break, whereas another kid who maybe is poor from a, you know, a neighborhood or, you know, sort of not well off, maybe that person's, you know, an African-American kid and the prosecutor has no empathy for that person, and then that person might get charged with a felony. And so that's how these race and class disparities happen at that stage of the process. And I don't suggest that they're intentional necessarily. Sometimes they may be. I think a lot of it is implicit bias, unconscious racism, unconscious classism, where they look and see one person and they see the humanity in that person and they decide to give that person a break, whereas the other person, they look at them and they see a criminal, a thug, and they don't care and they charge them. You know, and so it's and these decisions, because they happen behind closed doors, because, you know, it can't be proven that they're racist decisions, because oftentimes they are not intentionally racist decisions. Oftentimes it's unconscious racism. It's a very complex problem, and it ends up producing these disparities. But that's just the charging step. You mentioned also the plea bargaining stage.
Yes.
A lot of people think, you know, they watch these, you know, various versions of Law and Order on television. I think there are probably 6 or 7 versions, and you see all these trials going on TV, and a lot of people unfortunately get their impressions of the criminal justice system from watching television. They think there are all these trials going on in our criminal courts. Not so. There are very few trials going on. Very few people exercise their right to trial. 95, sometimes some figures go as high as 98% of all criminal cases are resolved with a guilty plea. 98% of people are pleading guilty, and here's why it happens. It's because of the power of prosecutors. In the example that I just gave of the individual who, let's say it's the prosecutor decides they're going to charge this person with 5 counts of the felony, a cocaine offense. They're facing 50 years in prison. The prosecutor says, tell you what, I'll make you a deal. I'll allow you to plead guilty to one of those felonies, and I'll dismiss the other 4 if you plead guilty. You give up your right to trial, you give up your right to appeal, but if you go to trial, it's risky business because you never know what a jury's going to do. Even if you have a good defense, that jury might come back with guilty. And the reality is that the majority of people have overworked public defenders who don't have the resources in their offices to investigate the cases. And prosecutors will go to that public defender, offer the plea, and sometimes I've been in situations, I've seen or heard of situations in which prosecutors will put a deadline on the plea. They'll say to the defense attorney, I'll give your guy a deal. He can plead guilty to this one felony, but you've got to give me an answer by 5 o'clock today or the deal is off. And the poor defense attorney might say, look, I haven't had a chance to investigate the case. My client may have a defense. It's my ethical duty to do so. And the prosecutor just says, too bad. Take it or leave it by 5. And you can see the horrible position that puts the defense attorney in. He goes to his client and he says, look, you might have a defense, you know, but I'm not going to have the opportunity to investigate it. And you got this deal presented to you, and if you turn it down, they're not going to give it back to you again. So you can see the pressure, how even innocent people might plead guilty because they're afraid to go to trial and face the prospect of spending the rest of their lives in prison. And that is what passes as justice in American courts today. And it's an outrage, and it's because of the tremendous power that prosecutors have at the charging and plea bargaining stages. And to top it off, those decisions are made behind closed doors with no transparency. I mean, we live in a democracy. which is supposed to be based on transparency and holding our elected officials accountable. But when it comes to prosecutors, the system just simply is not working.
What about the end of the process, the final disposition?
Yeah. So sentencing, right? So prosecutors have a whole lot of power at that stage. And honestly, you know, when you're talking about mandatory minimum sentences, and a bit, what that means is that the legislatures on both the state and the federal level have passed these awful laws that basically say if a person's convicted of this crime, there's a mandatory minimum amount of time they must spend in prison. And unfortunately, they've passed a lot of those mandatory minimum laws for drug offenses, nonviolent drug offenses, where people are facing 10 mandatory years in prison. And what that means is that if they have that conviction, if they're convicted after trial or if they plead guilty to a mandatory minimum, the judge has absolutely no discretion. The judge, even if the judge says, I don't think it's fair for this first offender to spend 10 years in prison when they have no record, you know, they played a minor role, I really don't want to put this person in prison, but they don't have a choice because it's a mandatory minimum offense. So really the power, again, even at the stage of sentencing, is in the hands of the prosecutor because they are the ones who decided to charge that person with that offense. They made a plea bargain that a person accepted. So they have a lot of power at sentencing. Even when there's not a mandatory minimum offense, judges tend to listen to prosecutors, and oftentimes they will ask for harsh penalties for nonviolent offenses, which is, you know, just an outrage considering that, you know, this nation has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with 2.3 million people in its prisons and jails, way out of step with every other nation with whom we associate ourselves in Western countries. So it's indeed a crisis, and I lay a lot of the blame at the foot of prosecutors.
Jumping back to the beginning of it all with the probable cause, the cops arrest mm-hmm. people because there's probable cause, that's a really low standard, isn't it?
It is a very low standard. So probable cause basically means it's more probable than not that the person committed the offense. It's the standard that police officers use to arrest an individual. It's a very, very low standard. It's the same standard in the grand jury when grand juries are deciding whether to bring an indictment. More probable than not. So it takes very little for a prosecutor to bring charges, which is why a lot of them pile on charges. They bring all these charges that they know they can't prove at trial. The standard to prove a person guilty at trial is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. You can't get a conviction before a jury unless you prove that person's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's really easy for prosecutors to pile on all these charges at the beginning, right, because all they have to show is probable cause to bring the charges. The defendant is looking at all of these offenses. Maybe the prosecutor can't prove many of them or maybe not any of them at trial, but it's daunting and they're afraid of what a jury might do at trial, and so that's why people feel so much pressure to plead guilty.
And grand juries, that's another route for a prosecutor to get somebody in the dock. Mm-hmm. Grand juries mm-hmm. are notorious for being object of manipulation by the prosecutor. I remember that famous quip during the Watergate trial where they said that a prosecutor get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they use a ham sandwich, but that's
funny.
The thing. That's the saying, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich, because grand juries are totally controlled by prosecutors. Here's how it works. People are called to serve on the grand jury. It's different from being, you know, asked to serve on an actual petite jury, as they call them, for a trial where they're deciding a person's guilt. Usually it's between 20 and 30 individuals. They're called to sit, you know, to do grand jury duty. Oftentimes they serve for about a month or two, and they hear case after case after case. And the only individual they hear from is the prosecutor, The only lawyer they hear from is the prosecutor. The only side of the stories they hear from is the side of the prosecutor. The prosecutor presents all of her witnesses, and of course all of the witnesses that the prosecutor presents are going to be witnesses that are going to favor the prosecutor. They don't present the other side of the story. The defense attorney does not have the right to be there, does not have the right to present any evidence. Of course, the defendant doesn't have the right to be present. So grand juries only hear one side of the story. Now, a good ethical prosecutor would present exculpatory evidence, evidence that is on the side of the defendant, if the prosecutor has that evidence. They would, if they're trying to be fair, they would give the grand jury both sides of the story. But there's actually a Supreme Court case that says they don't have to. They don't have to present exculpatory evidence at the grand jury stage. And so they don't, because they're trying to get a conviction. And so, of course, when grand jurors are only hearing one side of the story, they're going to come back with indictments. It's very, very easy for a grand jury to return an indictment because the standard is so low and they only hear one side of the story, which is why it's so ridiculous that, and I know we may talk about this later, so ridiculous that so many of these police officers who were charged, most of them weren't charged with these killings of young black men that have happened in recent years, but even those that were charged, I mean, no indictments were brought in the vast majority of them, which is a little ridiculous because it's really easy to return an indictment, but the prosecutors are controlling the process, and so they don't want the police officer to be indicted. They're not going to get indicted. Bring back to my point, they control the grand jury entirely.
Yeah, and getting convictions is a lot different from getting justice, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the Supreme Court, you know, in a famous case called Berger versus United States said, and I'm paraphrasing, it's not the role of the prosecutor to seek convictions. It's the role of the prosecutor to seek justice. And justice sometimes means a conviction, but justice sometimes means not charging the person at all. And far too few prosecutors understand that role and take it seriously, unfortunately.
Let's get back to the differences in plea offers, depending on whether a defendant is white or black or young or old or educated or charged with a violent crime or has a prior record. How do these factors figure in?
It's very complicated, right? It's a complicated process. So the American Bar Association has set these, what they call standards for the prosecution function. And what they are, they're sort of guidelines that the American Bar Association would like prosecutors to follow when they're making charging and plea bargaining decisions. Factors that they believe prosecutors should consider in deciding whether to charge a person or whether to offer a plea. And there are factors like, you know, the strength of the evidence. You know, if the evidence is really strong, you should be more inclined to charge. If it's not strong, you shouldn't. Another is the interest of the victim in prosecution, right? If the victim really wants to go forward with the case, that shouldn't necessarily determine your decision, prosecutor, but you should take that into account when making the decision. If they don't want to go forward, maybe you shouldn't go forward with the case. So that's another factor. Whether the defendant has a record or not, of course that should be taken into account. You're more inclined to give a break to someone who's a first offender than someone who has a long criminal history. But all of those factors, which appear to be race neutral and class neutral, actually aren't. And so I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a case where a prosecutor is trying to decide, you know, whether to charge an individual with burglary. And let's say the victim is a poor black woman who lives in, you know, a public housing, and her apartment was burglarized, and, you know, some of her jewelry was taken, her television, and so on. She calls the police, and, you know, an arrest is made, and so the prosecutor is then, you know, going forward with the case. And so the prosecutor then sends a notice to the victim's home asking her to appear to testify in the grand jury and be interviewed to prepare for trial. And let's say the victim doesn't show up. And so the prosecutor is like, well, okay, well, she's not showing up. She must not be interested in prosecution, so I'll just dismiss the case. And so the case gets dismissed. Well, there may be many reasons why this victim didn't show up. Maybe she didn't show up because she does day work and she can't afford to take off from work to go down to a prosecutor's office or she'll lose her job. Or maybe she didn't get the mail at all because she lives in a building where her mail is stolen, right? Or maybe she didn't show up because she's afraid to go down to the prosecutor's office because this is the same prosecutor who prosecuted her son and she's feeling intimidated. So she might have been interested in prosecution, but she didn't show up for reasons that have nothing to do with that, and the prosecutor dismisses the case. Does that mean that the prosecutor is being racist towards that victim? Well, actually, no, because he didn't know all those things. He's got a busy calendar, so he moves on. Or maybe she does show up. Let's say she does show up, and she's not well-dressed, and she's not speaking the Queen's English, and, you know, maybe she, you know, just doesn't present well, according to the prosecutor, as a witness, and so he thinks, I don't want to put her on the stand, because if I put her on the stand, I'm not likely to get a conviction anyway, and so I'm just going to dismiss the case. Is that being racist? Maybe it is. You know, maybe that is being racist. But the American Bar Association said that one of the factors that should be taken into account in deciding whether to bring charges is the likelihood of getting a conviction. So he's decided he can't get a conviction, even though the reasons may be based on his racial bias. So as you can see, this is complicated. But then again, it could be very straightforward, where the prosecutor is just, you know, exhibiting racism or classism. I've been talking about victims so far because, you know, as you can see, there's this discrimination against victims based on race and class as well as defendants. Let's say we're talking about a defendant and whether a prosecutor is going to charge a defendant. The example I gave earlier of someone being arrested and caught with 5 bags of cocaine, let's say one defendant is caught with 5 bags of cocaine in his, you know, let's say it's a white kid who's selling dope at his school. And, you know, he's, you know, college bound, got a, you know, well-off family. His lawyer comes in and says, you know, don't ruin this kid's life. He's got a future ahead of him. Please dismiss the charges. He's got a drug habit, and his parents are going to put him in a drug program. If he completes that drug program, please dismiss the charges. The prosecutor says, you know what, that sounds like a fair thing. He's a first offender, and I remember back in the day I used to do a few drugs myself, and if I'd been caught, I wouldn't even be a prosecutor today. So he's not saying this out loud, but he's thinking this, right? He's, you know, he's relating to this kid, and he wants to show empathy. Well, you know what, I have no problem with that. I think that's fine. The problem is that when another kid comes in, Jamal, who lives, you know, in public housing and is caught selling drugs on the street and is a high school dropout, when his lawyer comes and asks for the same deal and his parents can't put him in a drug program even though he has a drug problem, the prosecutor says, oh, too bad, I'm just going to charge you with the felony. And, you know, he doesn't see the same humanity in Jamal because you can't really relate to him. And I don't even think it's a conscious thing. A lot of times I don't even think they're aware of what they're doing. It's something called implicit bias, which we all suffer from. Every human being suffers from implicit bias. That is the views that we all carry unconsciously based on race, class, gender, sexual orientation, body size, we all suffer from this implicit bias. We're not even aware that we're responding to a person based on these, on their race or their gender, and we're acting on those feelings. Well, it's terrible for any of us to have implicit bias, but when someone as powerful as a prosecutor is making decisions about life and liberty based on that bias, it's more than terrible. It's unconscionable. So as you can see, it's really complicated the way that these disparities come about, and they come about for different reasons, but whatever the reasons are, it's unacceptable that we have a criminal justice system with these unwarranted race and class disparities.
We're talking to attorney Professor Angela J. Davis, who has written the excellent book, Arbitrary Justice, The Power of the American Prosecutor, and she's also recently edited a book called Policing the Black Man, another wonderful book. I recommend both to our audience. Angela, is overcharging, when prosecutors overcharge, that's a problem, isn't it? And more generally, what other kinds of misconduct prosecutors get away with?
Yeah, so prosecutorial misconduct is a huge problem in our criminal justice system. And actually, surprisingly, overcharging is actually not even considered misconduct. It's a phenomenon that is unfair that occurs, but it has not been defined as misconduct by the Supreme Court.
Amazing.
One of the most, yeah, amazing, I agree. One of the things I discuss in my book, Arbitrary Justice, is there's actually just one chapter in the book on prosecutorial misconduct. The rest of the book is about the legal actions that prosecutors take every day that, despite the fact that they're legal, actually create horrible injustices in our criminal justice system. One of the most common forms of prosecutorial misconduct in our system is what's called a Brady violation. It's named after a case called Maryland versus Brady, decided by the United States Supreme Court back in the 60s. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that prosecutors have a constitutional obligation to turn over exculpatory information to the defense. In other words, if the prosecutor knows of some information that would tend to help the defense, that would tend to show that the defendant is not guilty, they are required to not only reveal that information, but to turn it over to the defense so that it can be brought out at trial. Well, this is a huge problem in our criminal justice system. Brady violations are responsible for is one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions. For example, you hear about all these cases where people have served 30 and 40 years and then DNA shows that they're innocent. A lot of those wrongful convictions are caused by prosecutors who failed to turn over exculpatory evidence. That is one of the biggest problems in our criminal justice system, is the failure of prosecutors to reveal Brady. And it's a huge problem. And part of the problem is that the Supreme Court has set the standard so low, it didn't really give a good remedy for Brady violations. I mean, what happens if a prosecutor violates this constitutional obligation? There are a lot of things that could happen to the prosecutor. One is that they should be referred to bar counsel, and that's the disciplinary process for lawyers when lawyers violate their ethical duties, because it's also an ethical duty of a prosecutor in the rules of professional responsibility that they turn over Brady information. So they could get referred to bar counsel, and bar counsel could decide to discipline them by suspending their license or even disbarring them, but it never, ever happens. Judges rarely, anyone can actually refer a prosecutor to bar counsel, but usually it's going to be the judge who discovers it, but very few judges. Very few. They almost never refer prosecutors to bar counsel. So they're not even held accountable for those violations in ways that they should. Ironically, the only prosecutor I know who was disbarred for violating Brady was Mike Nifong, who was the prosecutor in the Duke LaCrosse case, if you may recall that case some years
well.
Ago. Yes, and so that case where these very well-off white kids, lacrosse players at Duke, were accused of raping this black woman. There was Brady information. There was actually DNA that showed that they were most likely innocent, that they did not commit the rape, and the prosecutor didn't turn the information over. Well, the only way it was discovered was because these kids had excellent lawyers. They had a team of lawyers who were able to, they had the resources to comb through, like, all of this really complicated DNA evidence that most people can't even understand, and the defense discovered it only because they had the resources to do that, and they brought it forth. What criminal defendant in criminal courts did they have that has those resources? None. You know, most are represented by public defenders who don't have resources at all, certainly not resources to do that kind of investigation. So when they were able to reveal it, there was a referral to bar counsel, and he ended up being disbarred. And, you know, fine, that's all well and good, but there are people who've been on death row because of, you know, prosecutorial misconduct. You know, and they've discovered that the prosecutors have engaged in that misconduct, hiding evidence, even affirmatively hiding it, and nothing has happened to those prosecutors. Nothing. I mean, they weren't referred to bar counsel. They certainly weren't prosecuted for anything. So, again, you know, the race and class disparities in our criminal justice system just, you know, exist in so many ways and at so many levels.
So, Professor Davis, I now totally understand that the disciplinary process is inadequate and that the legal profession has failed to discipline an unethical prosecutor. So what kind of reforms do you suggest?
So that's the part of my research I'm still struggling with. You know, I've gone through so many stages of, you know, what do we do about this problem? So I think it's a multifaceted approach. I think, first of all, we need to strengthen the disciplinary process for prosecutors. We need to, first of all, the rules of professional responsibility, the rules themselves need to be stricter. They need to be stronger for prosecutors. But we also need to make the process one that's easier, and we need to have more people make referrals to bar counsel, and we need those bar counsels to take those referrals seriously. And there are a number of different ways that can happen. I mean, one of the problems, I think, and I mentioned earlier, is that anyone can make a bar referral. It doesn't have to even be a lawyer. Anyone who can go to their local bar counsel and report that a prosecutor has engaged in misconduct. But the reality is that the people who are most likely to become aware of the misconduct are going to be the defense attorney and the judge, because they're involved in the case. I mean, unfortunately, because there's so little transparency, it's oftentimes hard for even defense attorneys or judges to discover it, because so many of these decisions are made behind closed doors. But when they are discovered by the defense attorney and the judge, as I said before, they're not making the referrals. The judges, I don't know why they do. I've talked to a lot of judges about this. Why aren't you making the referrals? I even had one judge to say to me, well, I don't want to ruin the prosecutor's life. And I tell you, I was all I could do not to scream. I try to be respectful of judges, but it was all I could do not to just scream at this judge. Like, are you kidding me? Ruin his life when he's about to put someone in prison for the rest of their life? Whose life is being ruined here, right? But I think the problem is that there, a lot of times there's a very cozy relationship between the judge and the prosecutor in these cases. Some prosecutors appear before the same judges over and over again in the same courtroom. They have a relationship with them. They become friendly. A lot of judges are former prosecutors. And so I think that oftentimes there's a bias there towards the prosecutor on the part of judges, and so they don't make the referrals. There are some judges who do. Judge Emmett Sullivan in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia is famous. He handled the Ted Stevens case, the Senator Stevens case. He is famous for referring judges, for referring prosecutors to bar counsel, and not just in the Ted Stevens case, and in lots of cases, because he takes it seriously. But there are very few judges who do. As far as the defense attorney is concerned, a lot of times defense attorneys don't want to make the referral, because it's one of those things, like, you know, the old saying, if you shoot at the king, you better kill him. Or I think that's, maybe I'm paraphrasing.
I think that's it.
It's like, okay, but that's kind of this is kind of what's going on here. Because if you've got a defense attorney who has to deal with the same prosecutor for all of his cases, if he refers that prosecutor to bar counsel, he's never going to get another good deal for his client. The prosecutor, because again, the prosecutor's got all this discretion when making plea offers. They could just be vindictive and decide, oh, we're not going to give him a good plea because his client's good pleas because he's referring us to bar counsel. So they're kind of afraid to make the referral too. So it's a difficult process. So we need to strengthen that process. The other way that I think we need to solve this, and this is what I've been working on most recently, is I mentioned earlier that the vast majority of prosecutors on the state level are elected officials. We just need to elect some good people as prosecutors, right? How about electing a progressive person who understands mass incarceration and wants to do something about it, who understands racial disparities and wants to do something about it? How about electing someone like that to be the prosecutor, and let's see what happens? And it's starting to happen across the country. People are starting to pay attention to prosecutors. I'll give you one example. There's a man named Larry Krasner, who is the district attorney for Philadelphia. Larry Krasner, who happens to be a white man, by the way, was elected to be the district attorney in Philadelphia back in 2016. I think he started in 2017. And Larry was a former defense attorney, a former civil rights lawyer. He represented the Black Lives Matter movement. He went after bad cops. He sued, he was someone who was on the side of making the criminal justice system better. And so he ran for office. He ran for the district attorney, and he won. He won with the support of the Black Lives Matter movement and African Americans, and Philly is a predominantly black city. But he got their support because they knew that he was going to, turn things around. And he has been doing phenomenal things as a prosecutor. He came in there, he fired about 30 people because they decided that they were not with the progressive program. So he said, okay, bye, you can find another job. And he's hiring progressive people. He issued a memo to his prosecutors telling them line by line, and all this is on, your listeners can find all this online if they just Google Larry Krasner. The memo he issued is actually available online as well, where he instructed them that they were not permitted to ask for more than a certain amount of time for certain offenses, that they are not to prosecute certain cases. He stopped prosecuting certain cases. He's having creating areas where people who are addicted would not be prosecuted at all, would not even be arrested. He is changing the bail situation where people are not being held on bail because they simply can't afford to pay. There's a long list of things that he's doing that are just tremendously radical and wonderful things to turn around the criminal justice system in Philly, because he's got the power and discretion to do it, and he's using it in a way to make positive change. Kim Fox is another example. She's an African-American woman who was elected in Chicago, and boy, Chicago's situation is terribly difficult. But she is also a progressive prosecutor who came in, asked the judge basically to release all these folks who were being held pre-trial for minor offenses because they couldn't afford to make bond. She's had told, you know, transparency is the rule there. She's opening up her office and revealing and publishing statistics about charging and other decisions that are being made in the office, and a host of other progressive reforms. And there are others as well. So I'm very hopeful about that. The ACLU, an organization called Color of Change, there are other organizations who are doing this big educational sort of campaign to educate people about the power of prosecutors and urging people to pay attention to district attorney races. So I have some hope that if we can get more progressive people to take over those offices and get people to pay attention to these races, that we can make change that way as well.
The murders of Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, and Tamir Rice, where three black people were killed by white police officers who got away with it. You write about this in the book that you edited, Policing the Black Man. And how do you explain the impunity of the cops in these situations? They were never charged with a crime. Mm-hmm. All three prosecutors were white men. How do you explain mm-hmm. what happened there with these three people?
Yeah, it's those three and so many others.
Many more.
It's something that is just almost unbearable, because honestly, the killing of black men, that's been going on since the time of slavery. I talk about it in the introduction to Policing the Black Man. These killings have been going on since, you know, the 1600s, since we were brought over, you know, to be slaves in this country, and they persisted throughout slavery, you know, after slavery, you know, during the civil rights era, up to the present day. The difference between the past and now is that because of cell phone cameras and social media, people now believe that this is happening. In the past, no one believed, you know, the cops would just lie and say, oh, the person had a gun, and everybody took that word for, oh, the person was, you know, attacking me. And even though there were witnesses who said there weren't, people always believed the police. Well, now it's on film, right? We saw Eric Garner being choked to death before our very eyes. We saw Walter Scott being shot in the back in North Charleston. You know, we see it with our own eyes, and yet the prosecutors either don't charge at all, as in the case of Walter Scott, or when they charge, I'm sorry, as in the case of Eric Garner, or when they charge, as in the case of Philando Castile and so many others, there's no conviction. How and why does this happen? Well, first of all, most of the cases, charges weren't brought at all. And the reason is getting back to the grand jury. You've got the prosecutor who's putting the case in the grand jury, either deciding not to put it in the grand jury at all and just not charge, or even if they put the case before the grand jury, because they control the grand jury. Let's look at the case of Michael Brown, right, in Ferguson, which is one of the first cases that really started the Black Lives Matter movement. That prosecutor, he put the case into the grand jury as if he were the lawyer for the cop, as opposed to being in a position of prosecuting him. He'd made the really unprecedented decision to release the transcript of the grand jury, and if you read the transcript, it's quite unbelievable. I mean, he was trying to base his assistant, I guess he wasn't the person actually in the grand jury, one of his lawyers in his office, she was trying to convince the grand jury, and she successfully did so, not to prosecute, not to indict the cop, which is the exact opposite of what they do in the grand jury. She put on all this evidence to just sort of try to show that the witnesses who saw the killing weren't credible. You know, she allowed the police officer to testify and presented his testimony like he was her client as opposed to the person she was supposed to be prosecuting. And of course, they came back without an indictment. Another thing she did was she gave an incorrect statement of the law. And that brings me to my second point. It's not just the prosecutor's power to decide not to bring these charges against the cop. It's the law itself. It's the Supreme Court. It's the United States Supreme Court. There are a series of cases in which the Supreme Court dealt with the issue of when police officers are allowed to use deadly force. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court has given a wide range of discretion to cops and a lot of power to cops to legally use deadly force against individuals, even when those individuals are not being aggressive. And just to explain a bit, you and I, any ordinary citizen, we have the right to defend ourselves by using deadly force if we are in imminent danger of serious bodily injury or death. So in other words, and I teach this in my criminal law class, if someone is coming at me with a knife or a gun or some other deadly weapon, the law says that I am justified in taking out my gun, my knife, and protecting myself against that person, even taking that other person's life, because my life is worth no less than that person's life if I'm acting lawfully. That's the law of self-defense. I'm justified in taking another life. But there are a lot of rules around it. It has to be proportionate. I can't use deadly force against someone if they're just coming at me with their fist, right? It has to be proportionate. And it also has to be imminent. The person has to be coming right at me at the moment for me to use deadly force. None of those rules apply to cops, thanks to the Supreme Court. There's some really loose language in a series of cases, starting with Tennessee versus Garner, Scott v. Harris, and others, which basically says that as long as the cop is acting reasonable, as long as the cop reasonably believes that there's a threat to his safety or the safety of others, he can use deadly force. Doesn't have to be imminent. The person doesn't have to be armed. It's just the cop's reasonable belief that the person's a danger. And you see how broad that is, and that really gives them a lot of what they believe is free rein to use deadly force against individuals, even when they aren't armed. But even under that standard, it's just simply unjustifiable. It's just totally unreasonable to suggest that that cop who shot Walter Scott in the back as he was running away, that he thought that man was posing a danger. How can you be posing a danger if you're running away from the police officer with your hands up, right? So it has been really hard to really take these constant refusals of police officers, I'm sorry, of prosecutors to indict and juries to convict. The case I just mentioned, Walter Scott, believe it or not, even the videotape of Walter Scott being shot in the back with his hands up, the jury came back a hung jury. They still didn't convict. And the police officer who killed him ended up pleading guilty, but not to the murder. He pled guilty to some civil rights violations, and he got some time in prison, but he was never even convicted of his murder. So it's a combination of the law being bad and prosecutors abusing their power and not holding cops accountable.
We've been speaking with Professor Angela Davis from the Washington College of Law in Washington, D.C. She's the editor of the recent book, Policing the Black Man. Angela, you went to Howard University, you went to Harvard Law School, and when you got out, you took a job as a defense attorney, a public defender in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. What do you say to people, and well-meaning people, and they ask you, well, how do you do this? How do you represent these people? What was your answer?
That's so interesting you should ask that question, because I actually have an essay in a book called How Can You Represent Those People, where I explore that very question. You know, I grew up in the South. I grew up in Alabama, and I'm old enough to have grown up during separate accommodations. I remember seeing colored and white signs at water fountains, in restrooms. I lived that experience. And so growing up, I always knew, you know, even though I came from a poor family, my dad, you know, didn't even graduate from high school. He got his GED in the Army. My mom never went to college. I grew up wanting to be a lawyer, not really knowing what that meant. I just knew that lawyers, you know, fought for justice, and because I saw so much injustice growing up, that's what I wanted to do. And so I thought I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer. I didn't really know what a civil rights lawyer was, to be honest with you. I ended up being a public defender primarily because when I got to law school and just started learning more about the criminal justice system, I decided that that's what I wanted to do. And believe it or not, and some people find this hard to believe, at first I was thinking about being a prosecutor because I thought, oh, prosecutors have all this power. I'll just be a prosecutor. I'll go in. I'll dismiss all the cases. I'll hold cops accountable. I was very naive. I thought that as a brand-new prosecutor walking into a prosecutor's office, I would have all that discretion, not realizing that if my boss, the DA, you know, wanted to do otherwise, I wouldn't be able to do that. So when I discovered that, I was like, you know what, maybe I should be a defense attorney. And I think ultimately being a public defender, which is, you know, I ended up at the D.C. Public Defender Service, I actually think I was a civil rights lawyer because I think being a public defender is a civil rights lawyer. I tell people this, you know, I look at my clients and I say, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. And by that I mean, you know, if I had lived the lives that some of my clients lived, you know, from broken homes, you know, with parents who are often, you know, always poor, addicted, who didn't have the ability to give me an education like my parents did, even though we were poor, I had, you know, parents who really understood the value of education and they pushed and pushed us. You know, my clients didn't have that. They came from, you know, all of them when I was a public defender came from homes that were broken. They were good people who often did bad things, but if I grew up like that, I would be doing that as well. So I didn't judge them, you know, and I saw them being in a system where because of their poverty, because of the color of their skin, they were in that situation. You know, if they had had a better life, if they had, you know, different circumstances in their lives, they wouldn't be in the system. There's so many people who commit crimes out here who never get in the criminal justice system at all because they're not prosecuted, because they're not poor, or they're not a person of color. And so for me, it was about fighting for the freedom of individuals. I always wanted to represent poor people and people who were in need, and there's no one more in need than a person who is charged with a crime in this awful criminal justice system. So every client I represented, I did so with pride, you know, and I'm also someone who always was for the underdog. You know, when I was growing up, whoever the person was that nobody else liked, that's the person I wanted to help. That's just me. And so, of course, you know, someone who's charged with a crime in the criminal justice system, they need help more than anyone else. I was so proud to stand next to my clients in the courtrooms in the District of Columbia and require the government to respect them, you know, and defend them against the mighty power of the government. I always took great pride in that, no matter what my clients were charged with. And so I feel like that work was probably the most important work that I've ever done or ever will do. I love being a law professor. I love writing. But the work as a public defender, particularly in the D.C. Public Defender Service, which I think is the best defender service in the country, it was just, I think, some of the best work I've ever done. And I would encourage I encourage my law students, I encourage them actually to be prosecutors if they're going to be progressive about it, but I also obviously encourage them to be public defenders as well because I think it's God's work, and I'm proud of the time that I spent doing that work.
How can listeners follow you and your work, Angela?
Well, I have the website for my latest book is policingtheblackman.com. They can go to that website and learn not only about the book but about me and my work. And also at the Washington College of Law's website, there's a lot about the work that I do as well, there as well.
It's really been wonderful having you on Law and Disorder. I read both Arbitrary Justice, and I'm in the middle of reading Policing the Black Man. I congratulate you for your good work, and thank you again for being on our radio show, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
You take it easy.
All right. Take care.
If
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.